Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Voices from the Grid. It is episode 2 of season 3. Not quite sure what episode number that is in the overall scheme of things, because I can't count that high. I am your Black Ranger, currently at least, Mr. Ben Taylor. And today we are going to be reviewing the redo of the movie. Yes, it is Ninja Quest parts 1, 2, 3, and 4. Not going to mention the fact that when I first watched this, I thought it was only 3 parts and had to go back and rewatch the 4th part suddenly. but with me is the whole group, starting out with our White Ranger, Mr. Michael Lindenbaum.
Hello. I'm here. I'm so full of BB Pop that I want to take a nap.
We have our Blue Ranger, the genius that is behind the command center, Mr. Brian Massey.
What's going on, everybody? What's happening? I'm bringing the energy, hopefully.
Yeah, you have to make up for Mike, because he's in a food coma right now.
I think Mike has the itis.
And we have our... She always complains when I call her the powerhouse, but she really is kind of the powerhouse of the group. And she's a much better Red Ranger than Rocky. Mr. Sacha Kaplan.
That's Miss, and I'm not sure if that's exactly high praise, considering Rocky's not much of a ranger.
He's a pretty good Red Ranger.
But the bar he set, I'm stepping on right now.
Yeah.
He's an average ranger, let's just put it that way. But hello, I am the fabulous, the ever snarky Sacha Kaplan.
So we are here to discuss Ninja Quest parts 1, 2, 3, and 4. I mentioned it in the intro that it's basically a redoing of the movie and a way to get the Rangers in the TV show the ninja powers, right? I'm not going to go into a huge synopsis or description of what is happening in the show in these 4 episodes, because we'd be here a while, because quite a lot takes place, right? But suffice to say, they're redoing the movie.
Right.
So, we open up with the Rangers at a volleyball tournament, because there is literally nothing they cannot do, right? Like, because of course they have the time to save the world, do well in school, etc., 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 and train to be in the final of volleyball tournament. And this is interrupted by the arrival of my favorite Mighty Morphin villain, Rito Repulso, who all at once is presented as an absolute beat stick of a villain, and he's also a complete idiot. So he's basically the evil Rocky, right?
The anti-Rocky.
He's the anti-Rocky. He's like the Rocky from the mirror dimension. Sorry to bring it up, Sacha.
Do not get me started.
So let's talk about Rito. What are your first impressions of our big old bony boy?
Remember that show Wienerville on Nickelodeon?
No.
No.
Because it wasn't, okay. We didn't get that.
There was a puppet called Boney. Brian is probably going, I know what you're talking about, Mike. That was like kind of like the first thing, but instead of a puppet, an actual man.
Kind of, sort of.
On that note, I'm going to say that was not my frame of reference. My first thought is, wow, Rita must be adopted.
Yeah.
But that then again, the more Rito stays on the show, the more you realize there is some genetic component.
The apple has not fallen too far from the tree, right?
It really hasn't, because he's sort of like, he's bumbling like Rita, but it's a different kind of idiocy, right? Rita's at least, she's a little bit of an idiot, but she has power. Rito has no power, right? He doesn't call the shots at any point. Well, sort of, little bit, right? But he's not the big bad, right? He reports to someone. It's usually Rita and Zed at this point, who he calls Eddie, which is so funny. It's so funny. And watching Zed's anger every time it happens, for a person who doesn't show emotion physically, you can feel it.
Big props to Robert Axelrod on that.
Yeah. I'm going to go ahead and say, because I wrote down a couple of thoughts. So first and foremost, I really like Rito. I think what he does, and it's funny that you guys said Rocky, because what I went with was, I was like, he's almost like if Bulk and Skull were evil, but like had power behind him too, because he's a needed comic foil for them. Because let's be honest, when's the last time Babu and Squad have really done anything?
Who?
Yeah. Like,
well, I was going to get to the Bulk and Skull comparison a little bit later. So
sure. So I'm not trying to like bury the lead or anything like that. But yeah, he makes a hell of an entrance. Mm-hmm. You know, and he's responsible for a lot of the stuff that happens in these first couple of episodes. And ultimately, I would argue he's kind of the catalyst for a lot of what's coming down the road. So he's bumbling and he's a moron, but he has already made a seismic impact on the show.
And I think you're right, Brian. He does sort of, this is like, we know that the season is going to be full of a lot of different changes and ups and downs for the Rangers. And so having Rito come in and disturb the norm and sort of the foundation of what's been laid out does set a really nice tone, because this is the real intro to season 3.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's not the last 3 episodes we reviewed.
Yeah.
Thankfully.
It's not
whatever. Mike has literally got his head in his hands at this point.
Kamen Rider.
I just want to go on vacation, man.
The thing that I like most about Rito is one of the things that I felt Zed and Rita were lacking was a lackey, right? They had Goldar, but he was kind of scheming in his own way up until the whole Zed's revealed to actually be in love with Rita. After that point, he was just resentful.
Right.
Like Rito is the epitome of a hired goon, right? He's just muscle. And
which is ironic.
Yeah, being a skeleton bone boy. He's just muscle, which I genuinely believe was something that the bad guys were missing. On top of that, we see that he and Goldar start becoming the new Bulk and Skull, right? They're a little bit more slapstick. They're a little bit more, as Bulk and Skull are going, as we've discussed, we'll talk about them a bit more later, but as they're on their journey to herohood, like, Rito and Goldar are going, making the trip into the comic relief. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I quite enjoy that. So, yeah, Rito's he just makes me laugh in so many ways, and it's rare that I actually laugh quite a lot at some of the Power Rangers, Mighty Morphin Power Rangers comedy. Anyway, and Rito brings with him the Tenga Warriors, a group of crow or raven, blackbird-esque humanoids that hatch out of eggs and serve as this season's foot soldiers, unsure whether they should teleport or fly into situations, because they do both. They replace the putties. We won't see the putties again, which is kind of sad, right? I mean, the putties made such an impression for the first two seasons. Like, the noises that the putties make are synonymous with Power Rangers at this point. How do you feel about replacing the putties with these Tengu warriors?
They have epic theme music.
They do.
I mean, it's kind of... Go ahead.
I was going to say that that was first introduced in the movie, right? So it's nice to see the music come back, because the music is really good, because Ron Wasserman. But I actually like the Tengus better than the putties, because the Tengus actually kind of managed to put up a fight. And the putties, when they got upgraded, were a little bit harder to fight, but like a little bit. Like, you had to punch them a little bit harder to make it work. And here, when the Tengus arrive, the Rangers are actually intimidated and they're surprised. And, you know, so I like the Tengus a little better than the putties.
I think it's kind of like status quo in a way to change the foot soldiers, because you had a changing of the putties at the beginning of season two to the Z putties.
Right.
And now
I meant a bit more. What do you think about, not necessarily the fact that they did it?
Yeah. I mean, there are some minor differences from the movie. Like, these ones don't talk as often as like the ones in the movie did. The ones actually like had full blown conversations. Whereas these ones are just kind of like, I think this is it. That's it. And then they would just do it. And I don't think they talked often. But it brought a different feel. But I kind of like the Z putties better, because at least when you hit them in the Z, I mean, and even Rocky couldn't mess it up. I mean, he knew where the Z was and he could hit the Z and the putty would just disperse. I like the dispersing putties, okay?
Like from like a cheesy factor perspective, I get that. But from like a, you know, good versus bad guy, you know, stopping the back, like, it was just like, it always felt so bizarre to keep sending these putties, because they were nothing more than a distraction. And then Zed decides to upgrade the putties by giving them basically a giant target on their chest. They could just like blast with a blaster and they fall apart. It was just sort of like, after a while it got old. But then again, Mighty Morphin gets old fast, so.
I agree. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, Brian, I was literally trying to introduce you to speak. So
thank you. So first, I'm not going to get into a giant discussion about the why and the how of why they have to be called the Tengu Warriors instead of the Tengu Warriors. I'm sure that there's some legal thing, but that, you know, like, being so familiar with the movie, it's a little weird even going back to like hearing Tenga, but you watch enough of this season, it's fine. I really like them. I think that they have they're dripping with even more personality than like the putties ever did. Mm-hmm. And you know, they're big, goofy, you know, bird boys, and I think that allows for more creative fights and more creative scenarios where they can get hurt, whereas the putties, you know, they're mindless golems. So you know, they're just kind of walking around going, you know, and they get like beat up and that's about it. With the Tengus, like, I don't know, like, I'm not saying that they have like way more brain cells than the putties do, but they at least have two to rub together so that they're a little more competent. And I like that in my henchmen.
I kind of disagree with that a little bit, because,
okay,
because like we've seen it in season one and season two, or more so season one than season two, where the putties were actually used for disguises and stuff. Like, putties were disguised as clowns, as potential classmates in school. Like, they, okay, like, and that's as an fair old woman that introduced Pudgy Pig, you know, so like the putties were actually utilized in other ways, especially in season one, that they're actually more resourceful, especially to Rita at that time. You don't see them being put undercover with the Tengus like the way the putties were able to be put undercover.
Do you think there is a downside to... Now, this is me playing a little bit of devil's advocate here. With the putties and the Z-putties, you knew when the putties lost the fight, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Because they exploded.
Or they just disappeared, yeah.
Yeah. With the Tenga Warriors, they have every... Because they are living beings and not these mindless clay golems, and they're not about to show the Power Rangers murdering the hell out of things, they have to find increasingly more and more ways for the Tengas to get out of fights, which to me, it gets to a point where the Rangers are just beating them up. And then stop beating them up for some reason. And then the Tengas regroup and fly off. And it just makes the Rangers look a little bad at their job.
Well, there's also been times as we go for this season where like they're fighting, but then they're called away at the same time. Like they're only supposed to fight them for a specific amount of time. Like, especially when we get to the Kim storyline. They're literally there to be a distraction. That's all they are.
Yeah, I know that. But yeah. What I'm saying is there are more scenarios than not where the Tengas show up, and especially after this episode, the ninja powers are used, and Adam turns into a 40-foot-tall man, and rather than just clapping his hands together and squishing them all, yeets him across the room. Like, it just makes the Rangers look bad at their jobs.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
I mean,
we know that there's a finite amount of them because they were hatched from a certain amount of eggs. And let's not get into the talk of the Tenga reproductive system.
Don't go there.
Not something I want to talk about today.
that's safe for another class.
Oof.
To go to your point, Sasha, about the Rangers being intimidated when the Tengas show up, right? I would argue they were just as intimidated the first time they fought the putties.
That's true. The difference being, though, when they first fought the putties, they were newbies at this whole game, right? Uh-huh. Here, they're experienced Rangers. You think they'd be... Without their powers. So it's sort of like, I guess you could argue it's even a callback to that original moment.
Yeah.
To kind of signify that this is, you know, new powers. But I think...
It's even happening in the same rocks. Like
pretty much, yeah. Same quarry. But the point being that, like, this is... All of this is done to tell us that this is a new status quo, right? We've got new powers, we got new Zords, we got same, not spandex suits, but that's a separate conversation. But we have new powers, new bad guys, new good guys. We have a lot going on. And so I think the Rangers are at a point where they're just as overwhelmed as the audience might be of all of these ridiculous new things happening. And like, you probably have a question in there later about like them losing their powers and and everything. So I won't dwell into it too much right now, but the Tengas are a way to continue the establishment of the changing status quo, because this is the last Mighty Morphin season. And that's very evident from this episode.
Yeah.
That like everything is changing, and whether you're ready or not, it's coming.
Yeah. So speaking of that, in the initial fight with Rito, we see the Thunder Megazord and the White Tiger Zord get absolutely trashed, right? They get Rito's there, and there's like four monsters that Finster has rebuilt and powered up, which makes me wonder why they hadn't done that before. But they then disappear again for the rest of the episode and are never talked of. And it's one heck of a destruction scene, right? There's bits falling off the Zords. You see the Tiger Zord's head fall off. Like, and at the same time, the command center, everything there's just going to heck. And the Rangers fall out of the Zords. They permanently demorph at this point. It's one heck of an ending to part one of this four-part serial. When you consider this could have been the first episode of the season if they didn't do the backdoor pilot, right?
As isn't even canon, so...
Yeah. As people who grew up watching the show, not saying you were necessarily watching at this point, but like as people who were a lot more, I don't want to say connected to the show, but you have a more grounded history than I do, right? How did it feel to see this kind of destruction? Like, I feel this sets the tone for all of season three. Like, this is the moment where you're like, oh, it's going to be that kind of season, huh?
When I was looking at, yeah, I kind of have the same notes about that where, yeah, this feels like it set up what season three was going to be like. Hey, things are not going to be comfortable. There's going to be a lot of really crazy things that happen. I thought it was pretty mind-boggling to see that kind of destruction on screen and to see our heroes fail for the first time like that. Because when the dinosaurs go away, they kind of just, you know, they go away, but then they come back in a different form. This was absolute destruction. And by the way, I love that it was American footage.
Yeah.
Of that. I thought that was really cool that they were able to, you know, play in that playground with Power Rangers Studios and do that kind of stuff. It's a lot, and it's a heck of a cliffhanger. And I would even argue, like, even though there's bits of her acting when she's doing this that might come off as cheesy to some, I think you can see that Amy Jo Johnson's acting has gotten better because she looks anguished during that scream when she's like screaming no, because they lost. This is it's a big deal. So I don't know, like as a kid, I kind of definitely took notice of that and was like, whoa, okay, this is serious. So what's going to happen tomorrow?
Because of the three of you, you were the only one still watching at this point when you were kids, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Mike tuned out like season two-ish.
Like sometime after the power transfer was
when did you tune out, Sasha?
I think somewhere shortly after the arrival of Lord Zedd. Because I remember seeing Lord Zedd for the first time as a kid, but I don't remember like the introduction of Aisha, Rocky, and Adam in the Russian dub footage that I watched.
Yeah.
Okay.
Interesting. Okay. What? So what about the two of you? What do you think of this whole scenario? Mike?
Well, Rito definitely came from the world of Mortal Kombat and chose fatality to the Zords.
Yeah. He woke up and chose violence.
Like, oh yeah.
Like, hey Finster, give me four monsters. We're gonna go with a fatality tonight.
Will say on my first watch through, it was sort of like, oh good, another bumbling, you know, sidekick. Like he's not gonna be able to do much. Mm-hmm. And then he destroys the Zords, and you're like, yeah. Oh man, we underestimated this guy.
Yeah. I will throw this out there. I'm going to kind of go backwards a little bit to your first question about Rito. And it's like Rito, while he is kind of like the bumbling idiot, he actually does come up with like legitimately good ideas. Mm-hmm. And he's actually better at executing his plans than Goldar has been. So like that's one thing that definitely sets, and then going back to setting the tone for the season question, that also alone sets the tone of the season, because it's like, yeah, you got another bumbling idiot, but this one's able to execute a lot better than in the past with some of the other bumbling idiots.
Rito does what is called failing forwards, right? it's a thing that is it's quite pivotal in a lot of storytelling, or especially interactive storytelling, where you don't want the people you are interacting with to feel like they've done something wrong. So even if they fail, there's a way to make that move the story forward, right? Goldar just fails. So quite often, Rito fails forward.
Yeah. Which helps push things along, which sets a different tone for the season itself too. So
yeah.
And so to go back to that question that you asked about the Zords, like even on my initial note taking, I was like, oh damn, the Zords are literally falling apart. And that's such an epic scene.
Yeah.
I think like Amy Jo Johnson screaming is important, don't get me wrong. And like the way that she tries to run forward and everybody's holding her back and they're all surprised. That's devastating, really. She had like a same reaction when I think the Pterodactyl Zord had like, was like going back into the ground or whatever. But here it's juxtaposed with the white lion Zord's head just falling out and just crashing. You're like I can't imagine watching that as a kid and not having your jaw drop to the floor.
Yeah.
So I gotta ask one quick question. With that tiger Zord head, did like Rito like post it up on his wall or something? Like mount it up? Like I took down the white tiger Zord. Here's my trophy.
You know? I mean, yeah, he has to have a little memento of his first victory on Earth, right?
Yeah. I don't think there's room in the palace for that, surprisingly.
But there's definitely room under the palace for that. And we'll get to that later.
Oh boy.
But yeah, I just I know that even as a, like I said, I'm coming to this as an adult, that was a brilliantly executed sequence, right? And say what you want about Kim running forward yelling no, it was very effective to cap off the first part of this four-parter, right?
Well, because you need both, right? Yeah. You need the human side of it, and then you need to see the devastation. Yeah. It's the same way that, like, you know, when things go kaboom in certain places, you know, it leaves it. It needs to that emotional impact to ground it, because otherwise, it's just another thing exploding.
Yeah, and I have to say that you know that the Zords being destroyed is effective when Sash is the one that says it's effective, because she's gone on record as saying she doesn't tune into Power Rangers for the giant robot fights.
Hey, just because that's not the reason I watch Power Rangers doesn't mean I don't care. It just means that's true. Not the primary. Although I will say that my issue is that oftentimes the word fights get so just let the rinse repeat.
Yeah, yeah.
That it gets boring to watch. I think the Zord fights get better as we move forward into the present.
Yeah.
I agree. And like, I'll say, as somebody who absolutely loves his, you know, big bad Zords and like loves that footage, it can get like, it, especially when you're watching filler episodes, it definitely feels like, all right, watch, rinse, repeat, do it again tomorrow. It gets formulaic, and that's where I start to get a little like, eh. So yeah. I can agree with you on that.
Especially when you can tell they reused the exact same sequence over and over and over again, right? You're just like,
That gets old. It
becomes a lot more evident when you're an adult about the footage.
Yeah.
Because true. But again,
seven or 8 years old, you ain't going to notice that.
That's true, but we are adults.
It's very noticeable when you're watching multiple episodes in a row trying to take notes, but if you're watching it like once a day, then you have enough time to go like, oh yeah, cool.
So we will talk in this season a little bit about unintentional foreshadowing And we will have probably the greatest moment of unintentional foreshadowing at this point, which is our first conga line of the season. I think I've killed Sasha.
And Ben chose violence with that one line and that one line only.
I love the setup. Our big epic moment of foreshadowing is a conga line. I don't know why I find that so funny, but I needed that. Thank you.
We will come back to the conga lines in later episodes. So the destruction of the Thunder Zords and of the White Tiger Zord. And let it be clear here, because they do deliver a line in the command center. It is the loss of the original power coins. They lead us on a merry adventure for the rest of this three-part story. And it includes what I think might be the most important revelation in all of Power Rangers history, and that is that Zordon found the power coins. How do you feel about that? I personally think it's the most important revelation because it's kind of what lets Power Rangers carry on after Zordon goes away, right? There are other ways to access the morphing grid. So I don't know. Discuss.
Sure. So yeah, I think it's really interesting that Ninja was the one that imbued the power coins and had that ability all along, and Zordon just happened upon this power to bestow upon teenagers, because it shows you, you know, it helps reinforce the idea that, hey, Zordon's not from Earth. He's just this guardian, but like there's other ways to access the morphing grid and other powers. And it's huge. It's a really big moment. Let's see here. I don't know if I had anything else that I really need to bring up about that, but yeah, it's just, I don't know if it was necessarily a retcon, but it's a really great revelation. And it's just another thing that helps set up season three.
It's also getting us to feel like this universe is bigger than we've thought it is, right? Because thanks to the introduction of Ninja and this revelation about the power coins, like, okay, so like if Zordon wasn't the one that made the power coins, it's this dude named Ninja. Is he the only one? And if he's not, or he is, then maybe are there other Power Rangers, which we now know there will be.
Yeah.
So I said this already, but we're going to keep repeating it because this is the premiere of the season.
Yeah.
I'm done with talking about it. Okay. This is the premiere of season three and I will hear no other arguments.
You hurt Dex's feelings with that comment there, Sasha. Dex has feelings too.
Dex
could go to heck.
It's not like I ever see him again or he leaves a very big emotional impact on my psyche.
Put that on a t-shirt. Dex could go to heck.
Because we've been kind of under the impression to this point that Zordon had created the powers, right? Like, even when Kim goes back in time to the Wild West, he's there with the power coins, right? So, Mike, how do you feel that revealing that Zordon didn't create the powers affected what we'd already seen to this point in your mind?
It's all lies, man. It's all lies. That SOB can't create powers rangers out of the wazoo, can he?
It's an interesting point.
I mean, which is what sent us down this entire freaking rabbit hole in the damn first place.
Yeah, well.
That 9-hour car ride. No, I mean, it definitely changes things because it's like, you know, because you'd always been under the impression that he, like, you knew he always had them. You just never knew how he had them. So it definitely gives more clarity to the whole thing with the power coins. Still doesn't I guess by having the power coins for as long as he's had, especially with that command center, you know, it explains why he was able to make a White Ranger. Mm-hmm. But it definitely changes it. You know, it gives you a little bit more depth, which has always been something that has lacked, you know, the first two
reflecting
seasons.
On the creation of the Thunder Zords, then. Because he says he found the power coins. I guess my question is, it's kind of a philosophical question, and we'll go to whoever wants to answer this one. Which came first, the powers of the Zords?
I want to throw this out there. Around what time period did the power coins find its way on Earth?
Yeah.
Because, you know, this is this is the one thing that kind of helped the 2017 movie that everyone likes to crap on, you know, because those coins, they were embedded in the Earth and they absorbed powers of, or they reflected of the time period of when they were buried.
Yeah. Sure. Right. Okay.
So like it kind of bring that into this equation.
But
like,
the answer to that is they never weren't on Earth.
But when did they come to Earth?
They were never not on Earth. We've got a question about this later, but the Desert of Despair is on Earth.
Is it?
Yes.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah. It's the Badlands in Arizona. You know, it's like,
no,
yes, it must be in the realm of Stone Canyon.
Yeah. But the point being, right, it's interesting to know that while Zordon didn't create the power coins, he was clearly able to tap into them, right?
Nindra could have given him access to that.
But remember, he wasn't sure if Nindra was real.
Yeah.
Because there's this whole thing where we're given the map and Zordon and Alf are like, oh, this was probably, Zordon's like, this is probably a myth. Like, why are you even bothering? And I'm like, well, what else do they have to do right now?
And if Nindra had given him access, all Zordon would have had to do was been like, tweet him or something, be like, at Nindra, please help.
He would have AIM'd him, you know?
Hashtag Rito rules. Like,
I mean, it's, you know, it adds depth to the fact that he found them. But it adds the question of, A, when did he find them? And B, when did he bring them to Earth?
Again, I think the power coins were always on Earth.
Yeah.
And that's why Zordon came here.
Yeah.
But if that's the case...
This is like the whole, which came first, the chicken or the egg question.
Hold on a second. We're going to get deep into this. If the power coins were on Earth this entire time, how does Rita know about all of this and Nindra?
Because Rita and Zordon have fought around Earth before.
All right.
I thought that was made clear. Yeah.
Yeah.
After 10,000 years. Yeah.
Because of that fight,
So, and as for the how she knows about Nindra, I got no idea.
Same.
Remember, Rita works off a different playbook.
What I'm curious about is if Nindra crafted these things thousands and thousands of years ago, and I'm just saying thousands, and I'm just kind of talking out loud here. I'm thinking about this, but I'm kind of also forming it up as I'm talking. So I wonder just how old Nindra actually is, because if he's able to tap into, because those original power coins were dino coins, and if he's tapping into the energy of the dinosaurs, like, I don't know. Like, I don't know the answer to that question. Like, I don't know exactly how old Nindra is, but if he's able to be inspired by dinosaurs.
If he's old enough to be inspired by dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Did he inspire the original ninjas?
Oh, my God. We're going down.
Everybody, we're freaking adults who are getting so deeply philosophical on a kid's show.
Kind of the point. We are debating Power Rangers history at this point.
Everybody listening, if you've just tuned in, first and foremost, thank you. But why are you coming into this point? Second of all,
we apologize at the same time.
I'm not apologizing. You can apologize.
We are currently very, very deep into what is now, I'm dubbing it the Ninja War rabbit hole. I want to know how deep this goes.
This is the Ninja Urn. It's not a rabbit hole.
No, right now we're in the rabbit hole. Later on, we'll be in the urn.
Yeah. Yes.
So anyway, moving on a little bit, because we'll come to actual Ninja in a minute. The quest for new powers leads us to the Desert of Despair, which is somewhere on Earth. Apparently.
Allegedly.
Even though I'm not quite sure how a desert that yells at people hadn't been discovered yet.
There's a very simple explanation.
But yet it's not on Earth at the same time, because they're technically in another dimension, apparently. And they have a map that they found with the power coins that they conveniently lose, that leads them to a unique rock formation that looks like every other rock around them, but also looks exactly the same as the rocks that the command center is built on back on Earth. And the Rangers discover the hidden temple completely by accident, by Adam leaning on a rock, because he's that awesome. And Ninjor, who imbues the Rangers with new ninja powers. There is a lot to discuss here. So let's start with the journey through the Desert of Despair itself and its many deadly, quote unquote, traps and unique rock formations.
I just want to start off by saying I'm glad that Dwayne The Rock Johnson was able to come out and do these fantastic cameos for Power Rangers before he became famous. I just thank you, Rocky. Right. We appreciate it. That's all I really got.
I'm queuing up a bit from Austin Powers. You know what's incredible is how the Desert of Despair looks absolutely nothing like Southern California.
Yes.
Larry said it's in Arizona. It's not in California.
I mean, they don't have the budget to recreate the movie. I'm sorry. It's like,
They couldn't have put some drapes or something on it to like anything.
I'm not talking about the temple here. I'm talking specifically about the desert itself. Right.
So my biggest complaint about that, because it needs to feel otherworldly. What I think might have happened, and the reason why I personally looked at that and thought, that looks just like anywhere else that they're on Earth, is the last three episodes, which I don't count as the beginning of season three, by the way, where they were hanging out with not Kamen Rider Black RX, they used like a reddish, brownish like a filter. So I think maybe they didn't want to do that like eight episodes in a row. Good Lord. Seven. My bad. I can do math. They could have put a blue filter on there to kind of make it look a little bit different.
One of the things they do when the Rangers do go to other planets is a filter, because they did it in season...
The Serpentera thing.
Yeah, when they went to get the Sword of Light, right?
But that was also because that's how the Sentai footage was already for that.
But you couple that with the way that they did it on Ignoy, and it becomes a running theme at that point.
Yeah.
Right.
If it had been a one-off just in the Sword of Light episode, then fair enough. But
yeah, I don't know. I feel like, especially when they're walking through like vast swaths of nothingness, they could have done something besides just like, woo, It's despair.
Well, the random rock that catches fire for no reason.
And shall we talk about the fact that Billy, the genius, doesn't know you can just step through a small line of fire?
And he drops the map.
Fire bad.
Like,
and he drops the map of all things.
Like,
because of course, something else had to go wrong, right?
Yeah, it's like
Billy can't be perfect. I mean, he has to have his faults too sometimes.
I mean, come on, like there's Butterfingers, and then there's this. Like that's a party foul. Is all that is. It's like, dude, you had. I wouldn't say he had one job.
Oh, no, he had one job. In this episode, he had one job.
Hold the map and make sure we don't get lost. Okay. Whoops. It's in the fire now.
Okay. Hold on. Let's throw this out there real quick. Who would you have? You realize, okay. Yeah. We're giving Billy a hard time on this. But you all know that if it was Rocky who dropped the map in the fire, this would be a completely firestorm on Rocky right there.
No, if Rocky had dropped the map, I'd have understood it because Rocky's an idiot.
Yeah. Like, I would have been sitting here going, like, whose bright idea was it to give Mr. I just want to have fun the map? Like, you don't do that.
Sasha, what you got?
All
right.
Well, even though I agree with all of this, but don't they establish at one point that, like, Billy has, like, a photographic, like, memory? They sort of hint at it, right?
They kind
of. Or am I just making stuff up?
No.
I want to say sure, but I can't 100% verify that.
No, they have, because there have been things that he has worked on where he's had to literally eyeball it, like, super quick and then try to make it after something got wrecked.
All right,
which is why, like, yes, he dropped the map and it was dumb, but like, it's
if he
fine.
Has a photographic
map, after he memorized it, they should have given it to Adam for safekeeping.
If he has a photographic memory, why did they walk to the command center at the beginning of part two and everyone forgot the rad bug exists?
Look, that car it's gone. It's never coming back. Let go.
He's not letting go of the fact that Billy invented a flying car.
Okay. There's a very simple explanation.
You know how when you look for something and you know where it is, but for whatever reason you can't find it, it's scaring you that it could hit you? That's the rad bug. It's right there in front of them. They just keep forgetting it's right there.
How do you forget a car exists?
I distinctly remember in season one, not to you know, be a party pooper, but I distinctly remember him saying something in passing about how, like, oh, that was a fun experiment or something. Like, I'm not saying it, you know, verbatim, but basically that was fun, but I'm tearing it down for parts so I can do other stuff.
I think you're right. I think that was that sounds right to me.
So that's what happened to the rad bug.
Yes. Let's take the thing that could make me millions of dollars, extremely rich and famous, and the best person on earth.
Okay, but also, like, keep in mind season one Billy and social skills and, like, other, like, like the world outside of his genius didn't really exist.
I mean, you don't need social skills. You walk into the meeting, they go, okay, what are you doing? You got a flying car. And they're like, really?
But that's the thing. Billy isn't Billy's not interested in, like, making millions, right? He's interested in making things that work and then dismantling them and making something else.
First you get the money, then you get the lab, then you build whatever you want. That's the thing, though.
Anyway.
Anyways.
All that from a discussion on a desert.
Well, there's nothing else to talk about.
And now
Sand and Rock's pretty.
We get to the hidden temple itself. I personally love the design of the hidden temple and the gardens they've got here. I'm an absolute sucker for that kind of aesthetic. And then there's, like, Ninjor's room with its recycled props and smoke on the ground and black aura so that it looks like you're actually in one of Zed's dark dimensions. Which is an interesting shorthand for it not necessarily being in the same dimension, but anyway. What are your thoughts on the temple in the show compared to the temple in the movie?
To be honest, there's no real comparison because they never actually went into the actual temple in the movie. They only were on the outside of it.
I was under the impression that the place they got their ninja powers was a ninja temple.
It was a temple, but they never actually went into the said temple.
No, because no, after they have that big thing where they all stand around and get their powers.
That was on the outskirts of the temple. There's
right,
like
but that itself was it's a temple. It was the Ninjetti temple, right?
No, it
and
was
then
like
there was another temple they were supposed to go to. To
guys, we blocked the movie from our memory. Let's not compare. But I will say that this feels more ninja than the temple in the movie did.
Yeah, because
yes,
that was very jungle.
Yeah, like the one in the TV show, like it feels like something out of like Kung Fu almost.
Yeah.
If you get that reference at all. It just, you know, it feels like something you would see in like a ninja or like a Shaolin movie. And yeah. I kind of love that too. You know, it's almost like an homage of sorts. And, you know, they did the best that they could with that budget. Whereas like, you know, in the movie, they're in, what is it, New Zealand or Australia?
Australia.
They just had forever to film off into. So of course that's gonna, you know, quote unquote, look bigger and grander, but like, this is a little more intimate. And, you know, I agree with, I really like this. I like how it looks.
The one in the movie, I kept expecting like a Peishwa master to show up.
Like, yes.
And you got a girl in a bikini instead.
Yeah. And you could have foreshadowed Jungle Fury.
She has a tattoo on her forearm.
Ninjor himself, the Dudley Do-Righted master of all things power coins, Q Brian's impression.
Never underestimate the power of ninja.
What are your impressions of our big blue armored boy? And how do you feel about this power, this whole power creation transferal technique compared to what we've seen in the past? And since she's got her hand high in the air, we will start with Michael. No, we'll start with Sasha.
So first thought is Ninjor comes off kind of like a jerk, right?
No.
And the part that I find hilarious is like, he knows who Lord Zedd is, clearly. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, that's a cute story. Bye. And I'm like, wow, you're a jerk. You're not even going to ask them questions, give them a test to figure out who they are. And his whole like change is basically when the Rangers go, no matter what, we're going to fight till the fight is over. You're going to fight till you're dead. I got it. Like, it's all about like, about they're going to, how they're going to fight without their powers, yada, yada. And then you're just like, just kidding. Come on over. I'm like, really? The world is about to be destroyed. Come on.
So I didn't see Ninjor unveiled as a kid. Mm-hmm. I saw the unveiling as an adult.
Yeah.
I think I might have still been in my mid to late 20s at that point because of the Shout Factory DVD releases. I just remember seeing it for the first time and I just started laughing my ass off because it was just like, you see this like big metal thing and then it comes out with the Dudley Do-Right voice and I was just lost it. I couldn't help myself. It was like, wait, this is the guy who's supposed to be the coin creator? Like, did he get lost somewhere? Did Dudley Do-Right get lost somewhere and then learn the powers of Ninjetti or something? But no, I do agree at the one point.
Powers. They're very much like they're not allowed to call them Tengu warriors.
Yeah.
They are very careful to not call them Ninjetti powers.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't really like the word Ninjetti anyway. Yeah. So I appreciate the use of ninja powers. Does get a little silly later on when their Zords are being introduced.
We'll get to the Zord.
Yeah.
But I agree with the point that Sasha made where it's like, he's also kind of a jerk, like in the beginning when you meet him. And it's like, I think that's kind of a nice little contrast because when you met Zordon and Alpha, they're very welcoming as allies. And every time you've met somebody who would be an ally, like when we, you know, after that, they would always be welcoming, with the exception of Drax for the Mass Rider thing.
Yeah,
outside of that, but most allies would always greet them warmly.
Right.
Ninjor became like the first actual ally that we would see on the show who didn't welcome them warmly and was like, get off my lawn.
Yeah.
See, yeah.
I will say, while I agree with that, the issue isn't so much for the fact that he's a jerk. It's the fact that he instantly changes his mind when the Rangers are like, well, we'll just go back and fight until we die. Or I don't remember exactly what Tommy says.
Like, would have been really nice is if, like, he turned the Rangers away, they'd gone out, fought the Tengas, and then he'd come out, saved, much like, not to draw a comparison to a much better season, but much like in Space, when the Rangers go out and fight, and then Andros brings them the Morphers.
Yeah.
But, yeah. The thing I like about Ninjor, outside of his voice and all the other stuff, is he's very clearly a prototype for things we're going to see over the next few seasons, right? Because next season we'll have Ork the Conqueror. The season after that we'll have the Blue Centurion.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The season after that we'll have the Phantom Ranger. All of which we never see a face. Well, the Blue Centurion and Ork have faces, but they don't move, right? They're just masks. And Phantom Ranger just has his helmet on the whole time. It's very interesting to me that between this and some other things that you look into in this season, it's definitely, well, does this work? Oh, people are liking it. Let's go with that in the future. You know what I mean? Again, it's mm-hmm. more, I wouldn't call it foreshadowing necessarily, but it's definitely
testing the waters.
Yeah. Yeah.
Seeing what sticks and like, oh, hey, people like that. Okay, let's do it more.
Well, I think also for that, it's also like, it's in the Sentai footage. So can we make this character in the Sentai work? I think even if Ninjor didn't pan out, they still would have gone on with some of the other ones and maybe try them differently compared to how they would have done with Ninjor and stuff like that. So it's like, you also have to play that little card a little bit going like, it's in the Sentai. How do we utilize them?
Yeah, because right, I mean,
what I'm saying is you wouldn't have seen a character like Auric or the Blue Centurion have such a big role that they did if Ninjor hadn't worked out.
Right.
They would have used a little bit of the Sentai footage when they had to and written around it as much as they could, right? But because Ninjor worked out, they were able to be like, oh, people are willing to deal with a non-ranger kind of thing. And Ninjor has the ability to grow big and fight alongside whatever Megazord is currently active.
And also able to put himself into like a battle mode as well.
Yes, he gets real, real mad. As at one point he says, he goes, evil makes me so angry, and his head turns around and he gets a samurai helmet, because I think in the
new toys for kids to buy,
well, in the Sentai there's Ninja Man and Samurai Man, right? They're two,
I think so,
yeah. Anyway, but the point being,
new toys for kids to buy.
Yeah,
very, very early CGI footage too, by the way. Very early. I think even before Toy Story was a thing.
An excuse to make another Fliphead toy.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. I think Ninjor... it feels at first like Ninjor's just going to be that guy that shows up to help the Rangers out when they're in trouble. But we know from our experience with the show that he plays a much more pivotal role, shall we say, towards the end of the season, right? it's quite interesting how they do that. After with post Ninjor, we get to see the ninja forms in action for the first time. These are uniquely American, right? There's no Sentai footage of these, right?
Of what
they did something a little different.
The ninja forms, but... the ninja powers.
The outfits for them, that was definitely American.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I've said in other recordings, and I'm not sure whether they're airing before or after this. I'm not sure if I ever mentioned it in season two. The Ninja Ranger forms are my favorite things that the Rangers have going for them in the first three seasons. They introduce such an interesting dynamic in the fight scenes because they can do so much cool stuff with it.
So just to throw this out there real quick, for the Kaku Rangers, their ninja outfits, the men were all black and the top like scarf area was their ranger color. Uh-huh. The one female ranger wore a white outfit.
Okay.
So that's how she did.
So that's how they did the Kaku Ranger for their ninja outfits.
I really like what the ninja powers bring to the table. We'll see in later episodes Adam growing to 40 feet tall and yeeting a Tenga across a room, or there'll be a point where there's like six Kimberleys, or I think it's Billy at one point merges with the ground and disappears, and then there's one where Aisha just talks at a bunch of Tengas, they dance and then fall over. Talk to me about what your impressions of the ninja powers are. Do you like them? Do you dislike them?
Just basing it off of this four-parter, like, it definitely brought a different feel and vibe to the Rangers themselves. It's like they're not just like morphing into their spandex and going right in.
I think it makes sense in terms of.
I was hoping for that's not spandex, but.
You missed
it. I can only shout that so much until we get to RPM. That's so let me savor it. Yeah. Let me use it when it's needed. My point being that, like, the ninja suits feel like an advancement of the Rangers' own growth as capable fighters, because if you notice, like, it's been a lot less karate tournaments and a lot more volleyball and extreme sports, so like it's nice to see a little bit of the ninja-ness the being brought in. And I really I don't like the masks that they wear.
Yeah,
because it just looks like cardboard cutout, but I really like the outfits. Like, I'm like right now I'm just picturing Aisha in her yellow like ninja outfit. It looks so good. It's so cool. It's really well designed, where it's like it's giving you that ninja feel, right, of like robes and things, but it has like those classic Power Ranger elements of like they have like their chest plate with their Zord on it, and like it looks really cool.
Mike, go back to what you were saying.
That's definitely not spandex.
So the movie did it right with those ninja outfits then. Yeah. Because that actually is a carryover. The only difference difference on that carryover was the face mask part.
Yeah.
Because the way they did it in the movie was actually a lot better than how they did it for the TV show. Yeah. Well, not just the headbands, but they actually did. There were times where I forget. Actually, it was when they got to the temple and they had to fight the rock statues. They did like a morph, and they actually had the face coverings too.
Yeah.
When they did that.
Which we'll see when they morph at one point. They'll do like a build up morph where it'll be like them and then them with the face mask and then the full thing. But we don't see them fighting it, which is a shame.
Yeah. But
Brian?
I really like the ninja suits. And I, treading, you know, similar ground that's already been talked about, I do think, yeah, it allows for a lot more interesting things that you can do, like, in film, like, you know, little things like, I think it was Adam who was, like, just kind of laying down on the ground. It's like, hey, I'm over here. And then, like, Nuzis his way over, and he's, like, mocking one of the Tengas, which is a fun little moment. Really like that. I did want to ask you, though, about when, because we're going back a little bit, when Ninjor was giving all of the Rangers their ninja powers, Ben, how sad were you that Adam didn't get to reprise his frog moment?
I hate that line.
Okay.
Yeah, sure, it might have got a laugh, but I quite like the fact that he didn't reprise it, because unlike when Dulcea or whatever her name is assigning their ninja animals, Ninjor is explaining why he's being assigned this frog. Not just, right. Adam, you're a frog. And he's just like, I'm a frog. She's like, no, the noble and wise frog that blah, 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 blah. So, I don't know. I was never a fan of that line to begin with. So
there is, though, an interesting moment where Ninjor is doing all of this, and Adam just kind of looks at his chest and goes, okay. I actually prefer that over the line about the frog. Because it's sort of like, well, this is like, it's more of like a face that says, like, this will take some getting used to.
Yeah.
I went from a mammoth to a frog. Okay. So. Yeah.
One thing, and this is my looking at it from a purely adult standpoint, right? Is it me, or does it feel like when they morph into their actual Ranger outfits, the ninja powers seem like an improvement? They can do more stuff. Why not just stay in the ninja outfits?
Well, we know that from behind the scenes, they were worried that, like, oh, if you didn't see the suits, yada, yada, yada. But I agree with you.
Yeah.
I think in a way that I think they might have come up with some scheme of, like, oh, you need to morph into the actual suits in order to pilot the Zords.
Right, then do that. Then have a scene that explains that.
Yeah.
Because that was never communicated. And I want to argue, because Ben makes a really great point, that the ninja powers do feel a little more, yeah, they feel like Adam, not a little more, a lot
like
more.
Adam can become 40 feet tall.
Yes.
You could have 6 Megazords.
Yeah. It's like, you could have Adam fist fighting Rita when he grows tall. Like, sit down, you know.
Can you imagine seeing like a 40-foot Adam grabbing
attacking the 40-foot Adam?
No, hold on. A 40-foot Adam grabbing a 40-foot Rito by the ear, dragging him out into the mountain area, right. And going, "We're not going to fight in the warehouse district. Right. We're going to fight over here."
A 40-story tall Rocky that still can't get out of her locked room.
That sounds an awful lot, by the way, like Ultraman, but that's neither here nor there. Because it kind of does. But what I was going to say was, it almost feels like the writers feel like they wrote themselves into a hole. So this is probably where they're like, oh, well, that's cool, but their other powers are not the greatest.
Well, it's like one of those things where, like, what the studio wants isn't necessarily what the writers are going for, as Ben and Mike are dying slowly.
Yeah. is this why we got the metallic armor then? Like,
I mean, anyway, we'll get to that. But it's another thing going back to what Sasha said. That this is just another way of disturbing the status quo, right? And again, it's a way of what I talked about with Ninjor, of testing the waters, right? To see how people react to new Ranger outfits.
Yeah.
Because we know next season we're going to be seeing the Zeo outfits, right? So it's just getting people used to the idea that we're going to have Rangers that look different next season, right? Very subtly doing it. I would be very surprised if they put that much thought into it, but
unintentional foreshadowing. Either that, I mean, or it was sort of like they didn't exactly, they like knew they were gonna run out of Sentai footage.
Yeah.
And they only had so much budget and so much they could do with the suits that they had that they're like, we have to move on from these, but we need to lay the foundation somehow so that people don't freak out when we do it.
I mean,
what?
Yeah. It, like,
what was that? The
Die Ranger.
Which is funny when you think about it, because in the Sentai, every season is a different outfit.
Yeah.
And nobody bats. Yeah.
Right, well, but yeah. Power Rangers is different at this point. Now it's, but anyway, let's move on.
All right.
Sorry, what did you say, Brian?
Well, I was just kind of going to say that, you know, it's interesting how the season itself is bookended with new suits and also losing powers. There's, and again, not counting the three part of that began this season, because if you look at like from here to right before Alien Rangers, which we'll talk about later on, with the Mighty Morphin Rangers, it begins and ends with them losing their powers, and it also begins and ends with them like having to try on a new suit, basically.
Arguably they don't lose their powers till the middle of the Alien Rangers saga, but
so I think that that's narratively kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's a really nice narrative sort of story.
Yeah, and, you know, Saban himself, I think, went on record saying, like, you know, we only had so much G2 footage, but then they kind of had an idea. It's like, hey, we could just do a season like they do in Japan, and we have all this footage that we don't have to constantly edit around. Because, hey, what you're seeing in the Japanese footage matches what we're trying to film here in America. So we don't have to Frankenstein stuff like we've been doing for the last two seasons. So,
well, they also were running out. But again, it's also like the issue of like, what other choice did they have? Because shooting new footage costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yes. Well,
anyway, I also think what it is that, like, I think after the show got so popular, there was a certain point, and I think it might have been after In Space when things were shifting over to Disney, maybe, where Toei and I think Saban started it together, where they would, because obviously the Sentai was always a year ahead, they would talk and go, hey, this is what we're planning on doing. This is what we're for suits. So they can go, all right, here's what the Sentai is going to be for the year. So
that happened before In Space.
Yeah, because they completely misled them as to what was going to be happening for both In Space and Lost Galaxy.
So,
because they were going to space, but then the Sentai for the few little bits of Sentai that I know, shocking, I know a few things, was that the In
Space... Did you learn something in the other dimension?
I'm gonna kick you. point being that the in-space equivalent Sentai was, I think, like a video game-centered kind of a thing, right? Happen.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Part four. We have a part four.
We do.
Good Lord, we have a part
four. I was in the middle of writing a question about, wow, it's really nice that they let it end on a cliffhanger and like not feel like they had to rush the ending and let it flow over into the next serial. And I was like, oh, it's a part four. We have the new opening credits, the same old theme, which still slaps. And we have open on Rito absolutely wrecking shop in Angel Grove's abandoned warehouse district, which is called out as the abandoned warehouse district. And the Rangers instantly...
Why do you keep building up an abandoned warehouse district?
I don't know.
Why do you put millions of dollars into this? Come on, Angel Grove, you could do
better. More importantly, how are there still people living in Angel Grove? Anyway.
Same reason there are still people living in New York City in Marvel.
Yeah. The Rangers instantly call on their new Zords, and we have what I like to call the first time showcase, where the first time we see new Zords, all the individual Zords, get to do a bit of a fight and do show what they can do, like a frog breathing fire, because that makes sense. But then in the future, they kind of forget that the Zords can fight individually and only build a Megazord. How do you guys feel about the Ninja Megazord system?
So I personally think that these are very classic looking Zords. I personally love them. They're very clean and sleek looking too. Fun fact, these were actually the second set of mecha that the Talker Rangers use. But it's the first that the Power Rangers use, which I think is kind of interesting. And as for what you have to say about like the individual Zords only being used a little bit, sadly, that's something that happens quite a lot in both Power Rangers and Sentai, which I think is a shame because there's a lot of personality and character in these Zords. You know, like the Ape Zord can jump around and run really fast. A Falcon Zord is a winged terror from the skies. The Frog Zord can leap many bounds. And I wrote this, by the way. It has a tongue it can use to attack enemies. The Bear is an absolute beast of a Zord that can tear at villains left and right. The Wolf Zord has a voracious bite and it's fast and nubile. And the Crane Zord
exists.
So, yeah. So, you know.
And what does that all mean? It just means build a Megazord.
So,
sorry, Brian. I didn't want to take your thunder, but that, you know.
Yeah. So, I think all of the individual Zords that we've seen up to this point, like, they all have a lot of really good personality, but these ones, I don't know what it is. I just really, really love these, and I might even like them a little bit more than even Season 1. Just some of the stuff that they can do. I don't know. Like, they look great. I really love them.
The only thing I would say is that they're... first outing feels sort of a little less epic than it did when like the Thunder Zords were introduced. Sure. Right? Like they were breaking through the earth. There was the lightning and the transformation and it was really epic. And you sort of felt like this is the new chapter, but I guess you don't really need that epicness. And I don't know. Some of the Zords I think look better than others. Like the Wolf Zord is a little disappointing. And it's like the design of the Zords feels a little like very square. I don't know how to explain it.
Cubic.
It feels like robot animals as opposed to, like, I don't know. I don't know how to explain what I'm trying to say here. Like, they just
I completely understand what you're trying to say.
They just don't quite work for me. And maybe it's because it's like they're experimenting with some kind of levels of CGI or whatever. But it lacks something for me. The designs weren't as detailed. Maybe that's what it was. I don't know.
Mike, what are your thoughts on the Ninja Zord system?
Okay, it's another Zord. I mean, I didn't get overly attached to this one, personally. Mm-hmm. So.
I don't think anybody really did, to be perfectly honest.
Because they don't last long anyway.
Yeah, I know. They don't last that long. Because it's like, I think after this, we go almost into the Kim saga, and then they're gone for the Shogun Zords. So they're,
which are even more blocky.
Which so like it's pretty gone pretty quick, but yeah, I mean, like, I would have liked to see the Zords do a little bit more of the individuality stuff, but like the way Brian put it, like, all these Zords can do all these great things, but at the end of the day, just get into the Megazord, please, you know. We just want to get rid of the baddie, you know. So
the individual Zord fights, though, because I think it's more interesting to see the Rangers demonstrate their Zord skills alone. When they combine, it's still cool, but it's nice to see. Like, I'm a fan of a good old fashioned cockpit. Okay, so like you sit in the Zord, You pilot the thing, it does the thing you want it to do as you're piloting it, and then you fight the bad guy, and then when that's not working, or you have a moderate level of success, then you join together and land the final blow.
I think that's, and I'm going to get crucified for this, but this is where actually the movie got it right.
Yeah.
Because, wow, I didn't get crucified, awesome. This is actually where the movie got it right, because each Ranger in their individual Zords, they actually were working as a unit while not having to be in the Megazord until the final battle. And it's like, you saw that sometimes in season two, but that was because Jason and then Rocky and then with Tommy, their Zords were able to do standalone battle modes. You know, from Red Dragon.
Arguably you can do with the Ape Zord.
Yeah. And so like you saw that with the Red Ranger and the White Ranger in season two, because their Zords can go into a battle mode. And you could fight individually. But season one, I think, had the most individual Zord battles, because you would actually see like Billy with the horn shooting the horn spikes, and you know
the Mastodon
back with the Mastodon with the frost from the trunk, and you know, and stuff like that. So they could have, they, I mean, especially these Zords with what they could have been able to do, they should have been able to showcase that. But that's just a problem, like Brian said, it's a problem in both the Sentai and in Power Rangers.
Which is funny. Sorry, go on,
Ben. No, you first.
Which is, I was just going to say, it's kind of funny because I was with a friend a while back watching some of Go Busters, I want to say what it was, which got turned into Beast Morphers. And what I really liked about that first batch of episodes is that they don't really get into the Megazord.
Yep.
And it's kind of nice and it's kind of refreshing. It's like, oh, it's not until like they have this moment where like they're able to link together, because I think, I don't know what, exactly what the parameters were, but like they weren't able to form the Megazord at first, and it was something they had to earn. And I thought that's really interesting, and it allows for more individual Zord battles, which
GoBusters has got a whole other problem with that though. But anyway, me personally, I can't stand the Ninja Zords. I think they're awful. Sasha's right. They're incredibly blocky for something that's supposed to be representing the stealth and sleekness of a ninja. The finishing move is garbage. They just punch it. Why not have that be every punch? The combination with the Falcon Zord just looks like, oh, well, you better slap a Falcon Zord on the back of this to make it useful somehow. At least when the Falcon Zord combines with the Shogun Zords, like the arms come off, right? But in this case, it's just a backpack. It's just wings. It doesn't do anything else other than let them attack from high up.
That would be the greatest backpack to go with in the school. And just have these wings in the classroom. It's like...
The Ape Zord looks nothing like an ape. It's a human. I'm sorry, it is. The Wolf Zord looks like a Shiba Inu. They're awful. They're absolutely awful. And to know from what Brian's just said that these are the upgrade Zords for the Kakko Rangers.
Oh, yeah.
I think I'm this avoiding that season. I'm pretty sure I'm avoiding that season. But yeah, it just, I don't know. Like, they just don't. When you think about the Megazord, the original Megazord's finishing move with this big old sword, and you think about the Thunder Megazord's finisher with the Samurai Strike, and then there's, I'm a punch it twice.
I'm a wreck it.
And then the Shogun Megazord has a fire sword, and you're just like, one of these things is not like the other.
Yeah.
You just want to look at the Ninja Zord and be like, were you adopted? Like, you don't fit in with this family. It's not a bad thing if you're adopted. Being adopted is fine. Just you.
We have questions.
I have thoughts. I don't know. The Ninja Zord, and there's a, and as Brian quite rightly pointed out, there's so much redundancy with having a flying Crane Zord and a flying Falcon Zord. Now, I know that's not it, the way it is in the Sentai. Yeah. But I wanted to see the two of them do, like, Top Gun flying around each other and shooting stuff. And, like, I'm like, Kimberly's been piloting a flying Zord for 4 years. She should be Maverick. She should be buzzing the tower.
I don't have anything to disagree with you on that.
Tommy's like, I got a Zord. And of course, Tommy has the most powerful Zord. Because of course he does.
Do you need a hug, Ben? Do you need a hug?
Anyway, let's...
Okay. It's okay.
Episode 4 revolves around sort of defending the temple that they will never have to defend again, even though Zed and Rita know where it is. And it is the key to all their powers. From this monster that was introduced in episode 2 in yet another egg called a Vampirus. It's finally born after being teased in part 1 and part 2. In part 1. And then planted outside the ninja temple in part 2. But the desert isn't on Earth. Because they're like, oh, scan the solar system. Oh, we can't. But it's not on Earth. But then they teleport to somewhere on Earth and they're in the desert outside the temple. Anyway, we also know from the previous 3 episodes that we watched that at least 2 of our number refused to acknowledge exist. Teleporting to another planet is a massive power drain. And they didn't have a lot of power at this point. So they couldn't have got to another planet if they tried. Anyway.
And the power of plot convenience.
What are your thoughts on... I thought adding the Vampirus monster in episodes 1 and 2 was a very good way for them to add a 4th episode. So they didn't have to rush the conclusion in episode 3. We'll talk about this later in the season. I personally think this 4-parter is very well paced. Right? When we come to changing of the Zords, it's really well paced for like the first 75%. Then they rush the dismount, as it were. But what are your thoughts about adding a 4th episode to this serial? Did it work for you? Did the monster work for you? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we're starting with Mike.
I mean, for like what you're talking about pacing, yeah, it definitely was the smart move to make. As for the
I'm sensing a butt in our future.
Yeah. But as for the monster himself, like I'm actually having trouble picturing the monster right now. Mm. Part of it's a little bit fatigue, but I mean it did serve the purpose of what needed to be done. So it worked. That's as much as I kind of remember off the top of my head. Sorry,
Brian?
Sorry, that vacation's coming in going like, you need to go.
Brian?
Mike, I hope you get that soon enough. I'm kind of with Mike on this about, like, I don't really remember much about, I think the thing was hanging upside down and Ninja even like remarked, like, how are you doing that? But that was the one thing I really took note of. But with all this weird dimension hopping or like scanning the solar system and where everything is, like I was paying attention too, and I'm still confused, is because the egg was planted on the moon first. And then
alongside the Tenga eggs.
And then I guess Rito either picked that up and took it down to Earth or something. I don't know. I lost track of that.
The Tengas took it with them to the ninja temple.
Right. Thank you. I mean, I think it's a good way, like you said, because you were asking about the pacing. I think it's a good way because the first 3 episodes are so, what's the word I'm looking for? They're so focused. There it is. They're so focused on getting the new Zords, getting the new powers, finding Ninja, or doing all this stuff that I argue if you had put a monster fight in that 3rd episode, we would have run into the same problem that we had with changing of the Zords. And you'll also notice too, like you pointed out, we have a new intro. So like the first 3 episodes are kind of like you know, we're kind of tearing off the old clothes from the past and we're putting on some new stuff. Like we're putting on new duds. And it's almost like with that fourth episode, the episode saying, welcome to season three, formally, this is what you have in store now. And it allows them to, because there was all that preamble, to just kind of, yeah, we have new powers. Let's use them. Let's not, you know, mess around. Let's get into the episode and the fight. Unfortunately, Vampirus is not the most memorable monster.
No.
I don't even remember. No, I think, hold on. I think the same guy that voiced that, voiced the one that was like, where's my Gooniburg eggs? And he was doing that Peter Lorre voice. But other than that, that's the only thing I really remember about him.
Yeah, I also have a note about the weird voice.
Yeah.
You have anything to add, Sasha?
I mean, I don't know what I can say that hasn't already been said. So if I repeat myself, my apologies. I think Brian is right that the way that the first three episodes are paced, there's not enough room to really give us this whole showdown and show off the Zord. So you sort of need a little bit more. I would say you don't need an entire if this was a movie, right?
Yeah.
You need like 15 extra minutes, which is most of the, maybe 10 extra minutes.
Yeah.
To really make a good fight. Because at the end of the, if you actually look at the way that this episode is structured, it really is only like 10 minutes of actual fighting. The other half is spent on the true heroes of the franchise.
Who will come to in the final question, by the way.
Yeah.
Yes.
So yeah, like I get why it happened.
I quite like that the Vampirus monster isn't that memorable, because the idea of this episode is that you remember Rito, right?
Yes.
Not this weird Vampirus thing. Anyway, the ninjas, the rangers, freshly powered up, show up to the desert to help out Ninjor. They summon their Zords in the desert in front of a lake. And they kill Steel Ninjor, and we get to our outro and the conclusion of our Bulk and Skull arc in these episodes. In episode one, Bulk and Skull overhear two young women talking about liking a man in uniform, and they make a declaration to everyone that is at Ernie's outside restaurant. Oh, by the way, Ernie's restaurant is outside this season because reasons. Except when it's not, and it's back inside again. But anyway, they hear these two young women talking. They declare they're going to join the junior police patrol, which leads to some hijinks with them getting their head shaved and going through assault courses and things. And we get to meet Lieutenant Stone for the first time. What did you think of your first impressions of Lieutenant Stone? What are your thoughts on this installment of Bulk and Skull's journey? And I would like to add, just in case no one else brings it up, I do would want to add, there's a really nice moment at the graduation ceremony in the finale of episode four, where Bulk and Skull graduate from the police academy after about 3 days. Where the Rangers and Ernie are talking, and Ernie mentions how proud of Bulk and Skull he is. And the Rangers are like, yeah, we are too. Which is a really, for me, is a really nice turning point in their relationship. How do you feel that then affects our relationship, the relationship of the Rangers and Bulk and Skull going forward? Questions have been asked. Someone answer.
First off, Bulk, I feel your pain when I go into the barber's chair. I want just a little off the side as well. Not everything taken off.
Yeah, please and thank you.
Says three guys. I mean, Ben, when I met you, you actually had long hair as well.
And then so I went and got it all shaved off.
Yeah. So as men who have long hair, we feel your pain, Bulk.
Yes.
But no, I mean, I think it's like you knew that there was going to be a point, especially if you're going to keep Bulk and Skull around, mm-hmm. that the show was going to need to have to really evolve these characters. And the best way to do it was like, okay, first they're just trying to be the bullies. Then they're trying to find out the secret identity of the Power Rangers. You know, there's always been like a continued, you know, thing of what they do to continue to build themselves up as characters. And this was that next step. A banger of a montage song, might I add. And I think it was the right move to put Bulk and Skull in this spot where they are, because it's going to add to many elements going down throughout the season and things that are actually going to help their growth and their relationship with the Rangers moving forward as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it was a good step for them, even if their motivation was, or rather, I would even say Bulk's motivation was a little flimsy. And I gotta say, in that instance, I feel Skull's pain about the whole, like, well, okay, like, yeah, I want chicks, but do I really want to join the police force? And like, Bulk just would not let him get out of that. You know what I mean? And so it felt like Bulk was making a major life decision for Skull for him, and Skull just had no say. And I felt a little bad for Skull in that regard, because I was like, look, if he doesn't want to do this, he doesn't want to do this. But like, he goes forward with it, and they're men of their word. And I think that's where Ernie was proud. He's like, okay, they made a big announcement. They said they're going to do a thing, and they did it. I'm proud of those boys. You know what I mean?
And if I remember right, I think the Rangers were at Ernie's when they made that announcement too.
Yeah. The only one that wasn't there was Tommy, which I would have loved to have seen his face. Just like, what?
Don't care like about Tommy's opinion on the subject.
Sure.
I agree that with Mike that like, and I think we're all in agreement here that like, this is the natural, it feels like part of a natural progression for the characters that are, on a subconscious to a certain extent, journey of betterment and fantasticness. And given what they went through last season with all of their babysitting and baby rescues, it sort of makes sense that they would want to pursue this. I dislike, but this is the 90s, so I kind of have to forgive it, that the whole thing's like, oh, the girl's like a man in a uniform. So, hey, at the end of the day, they are not just there because they could have quit at any time.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. They stick through it. They suffer through it. And they go through boot camp. I would say for all of this talk about this being a junior police force, I think they only called it that so they didn't have to explain why like 17-year-old teenagers that haven't graduated from high school are in the police academy.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. I mean, I know this for a fact here in the States. I mean, because Brian and Ben, you know him, but Dixon, he went for the JROTC,
yeah. Which
is like the military program, but it's done for the high schools. So like,
right.
It's, so in a way, but, it's kind of like that, even though it's not in as part of the school.
But the difference is that they get to do actual police work.
Yeah, it's a little flimsy.
I use the term police quote in air quotes, but like they're told they're on security duty, they're on guard duty, they're on stop car theft duty that happens in broad daylight. Right? I was pleasantly surprised when I first heard about Bulk and Skull joining the police force. And then the more I thought about it, the more I was like, okay, this weirdly makes sense. And I'm excited to see how the rest of the season pans out for them.
I want to make a counterpoint, Sasha. I quite liked that their initial motivations weren't exactly altruistic, should we say?
So I don't mind non-altruistic motives. I just, I'm at a point in my life where I'm just like over 90s girl tropes, okay?
Right, I get that. But I feel like, and let me get onto this, whether it was a girl trope or something else, had Bulk and Skull just randomly been like, we're joining the police, everyone had been like, that's not very well written. That's not Balkan Skull. They needed a motivation to get them to the point where they joined the junior police force, right? And I like the fact that it's not altruistic. And if there's one thing we've learned from Balkan Skull, there are like three things they're interested in. Knowing who the Power Rangers are, food, and women, right? Like there's these three constants in their life. And it will, anyway, I love Balkan Skull. I really wish they played out the police academy thing a bit more. Like, and we'd seen them having to like learn how to solve clues and you know what I mean? Just real, and it hadn't just been an excuse for them to do slapstick assault clause stuff.
But they got a training montage.
They did get a training montage. I will give you that.
With a slapper of a song.
But I would have liked that training montage to have like classroom scenes or a firing range scene or.
But well, remember, this is the junior police force.
Right, but you can still have someone with them showing them how to aim a gun or. Like, the whole point of the junior police force is to build you up to be a proper police officer, right?
I feel like there's weird things. I feel like there's something in there about Power Rangers and showing guns that existed at one point, but maybe I'm making that up.
Yeah, because they haven't had Blade Blasters since season one. But it's not a real gun, right? It's a laser. Anyway, the point being, I really enjoyed this four-parter, and I don't think I'm alone in saying that, right?
Nope. You are not alone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I liked it, too. I did have something to say about Lieutenant Stone, too, by the way.
Okay, go on.
So, as the son of a former drill sergeant, who has heard stories that, you know, I was a little more privileged to than, you know, most. I will say, here's my thing about Lieutenant Stone, because obviously, as we go down the road, he's a hard ass. He's, you know, it almost seems like he's going out of his way to make Balkan Skull's day awful. And that sucks. But in the beginning, I would argue Lieutenant Stone was doing his job. And that job was to make police officers out of these men. And they're doing stuff like slacking off, like on the course, they're like, you know, drinking like a martini or a Mai Tai or whatever. And Lieutenant Stone's like, he even says to them, look, guys, I can be your best friend or your worst enemy. Okay. It's up to you. And like, I don't find any fault with that because they're entering his realm. He's got a job to do. And these guys are making his life a living hell. So in that, I can kind of see at first, if like we're just talking about this, like this is the first time we've met him, I feel like, oh man, Lieutenant Stone's gonna have his hands full. But like later on, he chooses to do the things that he does that makes me just look at him and go, you're an awful person.
So, it's kind of like with the movie Full Metal Jacket with the drill sergeant played by Arlie Ermey. And you know, it's like, you know, it's kind of like a parallel to that, because like in the beginning, when he first introduces himself to all the cadets he is hard, he is harsh, you know, on them. And then like when they get close to graduation, he's giving them all their assignments. There are moments where he actually tells people, like, hey, I'm proud of you, you know. So it's kind of like that parallel in a way, where it's like in the beginning you have to be hard on them, you know,
you gotta whip them into shape.
Yeah, which is why actually, and ironically, the name of the montage song is called Shape It Up.
Shape it up, Balkan Skull.
So, how do you feel about, I don't want to inspire too much of a debate on this, but do you think that the evolution to what Lieutenant Stone becomes is a response to him being so harsh in these first couple of episodes? Because we know that they got complaints that Zed was pretty scary.
And possibly.
It could be. It could be like where, you know, I think what they're trying to do is like essentially make Lieutenant Stone, quote unquote, the bad guy, specifically the Vulcan Skull.
Yeah.
And as time went on, like they probably had to ease up a little bit.
And but then they also, were like, what do we do with this character?
Yeah.
But at the same time, they might have always kind of maybe had that in mind at the same time, too. It's like we're going to, you know, we're going to have him start off like as a hard ass and then kind of ease him up as time goes on, because there are moments later on in the season that kind of showed that he's like, you know, like when it comes to monsters and like he's like, Bulk and Skull, why are you always there when the monster shows up? You know, and it, and you know, he has that progress. Lieutenant Stone, in a way, for Bulk and Skull, has his own progressions as well.
Regressions is the word you're looking for.
Well, yeah, he regresses. He doesn't progress.
What I think is really interesting is putting myself in like the writer's seat, and it's like, okay, so Bulk and Skull, they go to the police academy, they meet this guy, and then like, so the last two seasons, Bulk and Skull have ultimately been unsupervised, although not really, because they've always had like Miss Appleby to be like, oh, detention or something. Whereas here, I think it's really interesting that, like, you know, they can't even cut out covering. He's always around. They can't really get up to like the hygiene that they got up to, because they've got a boss and he's got an eye on them at all times. And I think that's an interesting way to write things. I think I would have written him a little bit differently, maybe, just to not be quite so harsh at times. But
here's the thing. It's not the fact that he's harsh on them, right? He's sort of like, yeah, he's sort of like, he doesn't let them get away with things, right? But he does it to the point of that is detrimental.
Yes.
Right? Like,
and that's the problem.
That's something to talk about, like, I think at the end of the, when we do like our season finale conclusions, because we still have a lot to go. But there is definite disparity between how we initially meet Lieutenant Stone, because I remember through my first watch through, I was like, oh wow, Lieutenant Stone isn't bad. This makes sense. He's a drill sergeant. He's trying to make them good cops. Maybe he clearly doesn't take their entry into the police force seriously at first, which, like, let's be real, I probably wouldn't have either. Unless like we knew who Vulcan Skull were, right? So in the way that he behaves in this episode makes sense. I think afterwards the writers were like, what do we do with him? And they had no clue.
Yeah.
So I will leave it at that.
Yeah. Did they know at this point, silly question, that, well, they probably wouldn't have known, because that's in Turbo, right? With the whole him taking over the juice bar?
No, there's no way.
Turbo, right? That's not
Turbo. No. All right, that has to be something that happened.
Wait, is it Turbo? Like, oh, it is Turbo, because that's when they get turned into monkeys.
Yeah. Anyway, I think we've talked this episode kind of to death at this point. Overall, I think we would all agree that it's a good four-parter. It's indicative of the season to come, right? And it's a really good mission statement for Power Rangers going forward. Right, it definitely gives you the feeling of don't get too comfortable. And it is a great way to set people up for the upheaval that will begin Zeo.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So, that being said, let's start our wrap up on this episode. We should start with one White Ranger, Michael Lindenbaum.
I'm going on vacation. Leave me alone. No, I'm just kidding.
All right, you don't get to talk about your socials this time. Right, Brian.
yes, hi. You can find me not on vacation, but on Instagram at Draken22. You can find me on TikTok at BlueRangerB_Rye. You can find me on CastWaveStudios.com and on Twitter at OneDrunkGeek. And there's a new episode out right now that I just had put up yesterday for One Drunk Geek. Check it out. And yeah.
All right, Sasha.
You can find me being crying myself in a corner with grad school work, but no, you can find me on geekgirl101.tumblr.com. Always happy to chat with you guys. I've gotten some really great questions recently that are not Power Rangers related that I had a lot of fun answering. You can also find my occasional musings and my desperation for Jewish representation in all its forms over at Geeky Kaplan on Twitter. And that is Kaplan with a K after the greatest superhero in the Marvel Universe, Billy Kaplan. And of course, on the podcast, Nerdy Notions.
All right, Mike, you actually going to do it this time or are you going to keep whining?
I am rude. Anyways, let's go for it. You can find me on Twitter at @TheLinderBaum75, Facebook at facebook.com/x75productions. Everything's on the website, txhthockey.com, and for the show specific, /VFTG. Twitter for the show is at @VFTG_PR. And of course, you can find me on Twitch at twitch.tv/TheMichaelX75.
As for me, you can find me over at
Bob T. Goldfish
on Twitter. You can find me doing the video game thing over at
twitch.tv/321_TV.
And you can find the sister show to Voices from the Grid, Awesome Mania, where Michael and I, if he ever comes back from his vacation, to sit down once a month and watch through a wrestling pay-per-view. Riff along with it and do so with one of our friends. You can find that over at
txhthockey.com/x25productions/awesomemania.
That being said, it has been an interesting actual premiere to season 3. It has been an awesome discussion with my Ranger friends. That being said, we will leave you, as we always do on these group episodes and any episode I'm involved in, by saying, guys, gals, and non-binary pals, in the words of the 16th President of the United States, Abraham Lincoln, be excellent to each other. Party on, non-gender-specific honorifics.
And until our next more phenomenal episode, be sure to grab your power coins and power morphers.
And may the power protect you.
They did make a better movie, and they managed to do it without the purple goo.